have been blatant when it comes to racial discrimination, especially against the African American community. The case of George Floyd, an African American man who was murdered by a police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, is one example of many. Hezbollah in Lebanon, popular mobilization forces in Iraq, and Ansarullah movement in Yemen are against the interests and policies of the West. Therefore, they are designated as terrorist organizations by Western countries. That's why these streams have fought hard and are the true defenders of the rights of their countries and regional nations. Meanwhile, MKO terrorists enjoy the freedom of activity in the US and Europe, and even hold regular meetings in which European and American officials make speeches. West's support for such a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations. And let's not forget the Western countries, namely the US, support for one of the biggest violators of human rights, the Israeli regime. An illegitimate regime that has a long list of human rights violations, including the occupation of Palestinian land, illegal settlement activities, inhumane blockade on Palestinians, administrative detentions, and many others.
There needs to be a unity on combating those who commit acts of terrorism internationally, rather than this sort of use of the terrorist group as allies, and then giving them international support and international legitimacy. MKO is the perfect example of this, but unfortunately is not the only one.
The US, Britain, and France are among violators of human rights. They use sanctions to pressure other governments to give in to their demands, while that directly affects the civilian population and causes hardship for them. These countries have not only supported dictatorial regimes like Saudi Arabia, whom they have sold weapons to in a war on Yemen, they have also supported the Israeli regime that violates Palestinian rights. Meanwhile, the West's anti-Iran obsession and shameful support for terrorism smacks of double standards.
In the limelight.
The unexpected onset of the COVID-19 pandemic and the shift of workspace have led to a rapid increase in cyber attacks across the world. According to Checkpoint Research, the number of ransomware assaults worldwide increased by 102% in 2021. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff reporter of UKTN website. This article is published under the heading, Cyber Budgets of UK Enterprises Shrank During COVID-19 Pandemic, Report Shows. Stay tuned for more. The unexpected onset of the COVID-19 pandemic and the shift of workspace have led to a rapid increase in cyber attacks across the world. According to Checkpoint Research, the number of ransomware assaults worldwide increased by 102% in 2021. Recently, SRM, London-based cybersecurity risk and intelligence consultancy company, conducted research on the cyber budgets of UK enterprises. According to the findings, the cyber budgets of UK enterprises actually shrank during the pandemic. This left cyber spending stagnating at an average of around £18 million, approximately $24.9 million, for the 2021 financial year. This is despite the fact that 79% reported having suffered a major cyber incident. Of this group, the majority, about 73%, had experienced an incident in the past 3 years. The report says that over half, that is 54% of organizations, either hit pause or decreased their cyber budgets during the pandemic. However, now IT leaders expect to increase their cyber budget by an average of 7.4% in the next 12 months, taking the average budget to £19.4 million. But taking into account inflation, which is currently 3%, this still may not be enough to make up for the lost time during the pandemic, says the report. If this trend continues, a cyber spending deficit will emerge that makes businesses more vulnerable to cyber incidents as attacks become more frequent and more sophisticated, says the report. According to the findings, the problem is compounded by a lack of confidence among decision makers in how they spend their cyber budgets. Around 40% said their organization needed a better understanding of how to prioritize areas for cyber investment. Half, that is 50%, reported they had a cyber strategy but had not been able to fully implement it. Businesses need to act now to lock in their cyber spending for next year, said Jamie Smith, head of cybersecurity at SRM. The readiness with which we saw businesses pull back their budgets during the pandemic is concerning. Next year's cyber budgets cannot be future-proofed against all forms of disruption, but their trends business leaders should watch closely. A major one is the rising cost of cyber insurance. Premiums are going up. This is because cyber attacks are becoming more frequent. What's more, insurers are looking to reduce the risk they take on when they provide cyber policies. As a result, insurers want companies to prove how cyber resilient they are before providing cover. UK cyber budgets shrunk at a time when the cost of cybercrime and frequency of attacks is increasing at an alarming rate. The average immediate damage of a cyber incident is in the region of £1.3 million. But the secondary costs, like higher insurance premiums and recovery services, can be more than double this. Businesses have been failing to keep pace. And if they don't commit to strategic investment in their cybersecurity, they risk serious financial and reputational damage.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in Hull.
Tour the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station Choo Choo Kachoo. It's the youth station for you. I'm your train driver today, Muzaffar Haider. Here is the conductor.
You introduce yourself again.
Mehdi Najafi. Guys, yeah. This is Mehdi Najafi.
Welcome.
When I was really little, in fact, not even really little, I think I must have been around 15. So I was in a really bad school and stuff. So I saw a fire extinguisher. And we were a fire extinguisher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we used to pull the pins off them.
Yeah, and then?
But then one thing led to another, and then eventually I walked into a classroom, and, you know, it was an ICT classroom. Everybody's sitting at their computers, and they're all chatting away, and the teacher wasn't looking. So we walked past it, and I pushed the fire extinguisher, and I thought it would just be a little squirt, but it was one of those kind of explosive fire extinguishers. Yeah. It just goes, and everywhere was just full of this white puffy foam.
Yeah.
And then we quickly ran out again. So I think it was a little while before that I realized that obeying the rules is just not fun. It's much more fun to break the rules.
Yeah. Well, just the fact that you know that you're breaking the rules gives you this blood rush.
Yeah.
When you're a kid,
if
you get addicted to that blood rush, then you grow old with that blood rush.
Yeah, is it a bad thing?
Yeah. What?
I'm still breaking loads of rules, so I'm cool with that.
Yeah, whose rules are you breaking?
The Tawhut's rules now, you know.
Yeah, you know, if you want to be a rebel on the right side.
Yeah, son. But the rebellious streak in and of itself is a good thing.
Yeah, if you channel it rightly.
How do you channel it rightly?
Against the right enemy. It's been a long time since humanity has realized that there is an enemy within them.
Yeah.
You know?
I wanted to discuss the idea of this premise, actually, which we've just confirmed. You know, this premise that breaking the rules is fun.
You know that?
Obeying the rules is boring.
It is. Why?
Huh?
Why? Because it is in the nature of the human being to be tempted towards certain things that he is being blocked away from, stopped from.
Yeah, the one tree that Adam was told, Prophet Adam.
Yeah.
The one tree, don't go to this tree. And what does he do? He goes to that very tree.
Yeah, and if he wasn't told, he might like...
Yeah, he wouldn't have noticed it.
Yeah, there's this joke I got reminded of. This guy goes to a fake doctor, and fake doctor, like a spiritual fake doctor,
yeah.
Right? And he goes to him, he's like, I've got this problem. He's like, I've got the cure for you. Pray a two-unit prayer, right? He's a fake spiritual doctor.
Right.
He's like, pray a two-unit prayer, but don't think about a rabbit. He's like, don't think about a rabbit,
right?
So if he hadn't told him, he would never thought of a rabbit. Like, but now that the guy told him to not think about a rabbit, all he's thinking about in that prayer is the
That's
rabbit.
That's actually really brilliant what you just said. You know? Wait, is there more to the story?
Sorry? No, that's the story. Like, when you're told not to do something, it just sticks to your head, you know?
Right.
And that fake doctor knew he was smart, right? You have to be smart to be fake sometimes. And
yeah.
I don't have the cure for his problem. Uh-huh. But if I'm going to tell him to do something that he can't do, then he can't complain, you know? He's like, don't think about a rabbit. And all he could think about was a rabbit.
All the time, the shayateen are telling us, don't think about this, don't think about that. It's not always the voice of God, guys.
Yeah.
The shayateen are very clever at what they do, and sometimes they're just putting these messages in. They might put don't before the sentence, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the sentence is still there. Somebody said that it's really profound that the human race is so strange that they have to be told not to kill. Have you thought about that? Like the Ten Commandments, for example.
Wow,
one of the commands is don't kill. Now, why should the human being need to be told something which is so inherently obvious? Why? Have you thought about that? That means that there's something within us. We are hardwired to do things which are evil in nature, to kill others. Think about it. You're spilling the blood of another human being. Well, we who are more or less from a civilized society, modern society, we can never even dream about it. But this is what we are. And so sometimes we actually need to be told not to do the most obvious things. It's like a child, you know. This fire is going to burn you. Don't put your hands in the fire. And then he goes and tries to do it. And then he realizes that this is actually going to hurt me. I should have listened to daddy or mummy.
It does depend on the society itself also, right? Because they were told that we do need to analyze what kind of history that they had and what kind of mental upbringing in the generations before them and that specific generation itself had, right? The type that they were, they had to be told, right? Not every human being has to be told, do not kill, right? Some people have grown into enjoying certain things and others do not enjoy that thing, right? And why did you say that it was always fun breaking the rules? Because you had grown to like that feeling of breaking the rules, right?
I guess, but it can also be argued the rules were just genuinely boring. You wanted to just sit and listen to the teacher. This is boring.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as we said, that depends whose rules you're breaking. Right?
Sometimes if you get a really good teacher, obeying the rules is more fun than disobeying them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really rare, unfortunately. All right, I'm going to ask you to just hold that thought. We're going to come right back after a break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Yeah, some teachers are so engulfing that you actually like their company. They make it so enjoyable, the lessons and the rewards or little tricks and treats and all these stars that they put on different charts and boards.
I guess if that's actually a big key that we've just uncovered, found. Look, that then depends on how you view Allah. Do you see him as that boring teacher or do you see him as that fun, exciting teacher? See, when you're in the class and you're listening to the boring teacher, it is boring and you want to now break the rules. But if you're like in a bright classroom with the teacher who's really expanding your mind and your vision and, you know, the class is enthusiastic about, if you're seeing God as that kind of teacher, then you will get pleasure from obeying him. Now, if you look at the majority of people who have that rebellious streak and it's being misdirected, especially the youths, when they're not interested in the deen, it's because they see the deen as black and grey and dull. Those youths who get inspired by the deen, though, they are those who recognize that, wow, this deen is amazing.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, once at night, the middle of the night, he was going somewhere. And one of the companions saw him and said, where are you going? He was going in a rush, you know, like when there's a room full of candy and you let a little child off and he just runs towards the candy. He doesn't even look back who's behind him or who's calling out to him, you know. Imam Ali, he was going, like, with that passion, he was running up. And the companion asked, where are you going right back? Like, saw the enthusiasm in Imam after midnight. And Imam says, da'ni. He's like, leave me. Where was he going? To pray Salatul Layl.
Okay.
It was like, I'm going towards my Mahbub. That is the pleasure that he gets out of this conversation, Salatul Layl with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah.
And that's the enthusiasm, right?
Yeah.
So it comes back to what you just said. He has found the fun, he's found the enjoyment in nearness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
What are the barriers to finding that fun? How do you... Because look, so much of this is the trick between enjoying destroying your akhirah and the fun in making your akhirah. You can get pleasure from both of them, right? How do you do it? This dunya is going to end eventually. How do you enjoy those things which are good for you? How? How do you enjoy the salah? Let's go to the highest example. If your salah is accepted according to the ahadith, all your amal is accepted. But, you know, we'll use salah as an example, but it can be applied to your homework or your chores or whatever you need to do. How do you do it? How do you enjoy it? What are the barriers that stop you from enjoying it?
Ourselves. There's a book by Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, about prayer. He explains the way you can pray. There are certain things, for example, when we pray, we have to be sure that there's nothing that is waiting after prayer. Like, so if I'm anticipating something after prayer, material, my mind's diverted towards that thing. You know, I have to be calm. I have to be relieved physically. I have to be, like, certain things those are the physical aspects to it. And, you know, I don't want to be someone who's an example of لِمَ تَقُولُونَ مَا لَا تَفْعَلُونَ, you know, why do you say something that you do not do yourself? But as we've been taught, and as we might have experienced to a very minor level, abstaining from certain things, you know, does give you a certain pleasure. Tangible example is not eating for a long time. Have the same ice cream with a full stomach and try having that the same ice cream after 8 hours of no food. Which one are you going to enjoy?
The one where you had no food.
No food, no. Right? Yeah. And what I'm trying to point to is that certain abstinence does have a hidden pleasure to it.
Man, hence comes in the religion of Islam and those parents who actually limit us as well, because we don't realize how much they've actually extended and increased our pleasure of life. That's what Islam really did. That's what good parents really did. Okay, now let me give you the example of PlayStation, right? I was only allowed to play PlayStation on the weekend for an hour, maximum 2 hours.
Wow.
Because all my friends got to play it whenever they wanted, every single day. If they weren't in school, they were playing PlayStation. And one of my friends, his name was Stevie, and I was really, really jealous of him, man. He could play PlayStation any time, literally, he wanted to. And he was bored of it. When I look back, I realized he was absolutely bored of, to the point where he would actually take his PlayStation games. I remember he took Crash Bandicoot 3, which was a brilliant game back then, and he snapped it.
That bored.
He was that bored. I said, what are you going to do with it? I really want to play that game. I only get to play on the weekend and stuff. He said, no, I'm probably going to just break it. I was like, kids are really mean, man. He took my... He lent it to me, so I played the entire game, right? Took me weeks and weeks because I only get to play on the weekend. But I was really, really... I was like, oh, that's such a good game. I love it. I enjoy it so much. He took it back just so he could break it. But anyway, my point was, because he wasn't limited, he did not enjoy it. His pleasure became less and less and less.
Which is why we see that in our society we're going towards drugs and superior drugs and superior drugs. A sober life isn't enjoyable anymore because you have no restrictions.
You have no restrictions.
Right? Can we head for a break so I can...
Oh, you need a break?
Yeah, I need a break.
All right. Yeah, no, that's fine. We'll come back after a break then. In other words, if you want to extend your pleasure, restrict yourself. And that's what Islam is actually... It's all just a fantasy. It's a trick. Dear youths out there, if you ever think that Islam is there to burden you and to take away your pleasure, it's not. It is actually there to increase your enjoyment of life. Only those who fast will know the enjoyment of that first date.
The edible date,
yeah.
Only those who do understand the pure relationship of a legitimate Islamic marriage are going to understand the real pleasure of a date.
Now, obeying such rule, it's actually extending the pleasure and the fun of life. A lot of people do think that, assume that, oh, well, it's restricting me, I'm not going to be able to have fun and not even enjoy it.
Extending the fun is the right word for it, right? There's so many people. Go out in the West. What do you see? What do you see in terms of people's psychological state, mental state, after, say, a Saturday night? Sunday.
Really bad.
Sunday,
depression,
right?
Depression.
Friday
sadness.
And Saturday is okay. They're in the bubble. But what happens after that bubble has popped? Sunday. Your life is limited to 1 week. You're looking forward to that Friday and that Saturday night, and even at that Saturday night, within that, there's nothing left for you now, right? And you feel that emptiness once that's gone, right? What's that pleasure? How long does that pleasure last? Oh, if you call it pleasure, right?
Not very long.
A few hours,
and that's
right?
Why people are just completely depressed. They do get depressed because of this kind of lifestyle. That's all we have time for, unfortunately. Inshallah, in the future, we'll discuss it more if Allah gives us the tawfiq. From myself and from Brother Mahdi Najafi, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Palestinian olive farmers say attacks under the watchful eye of the Zionist regime army have destroyed the otherwise festive harvest season. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Shata Hamad Ryder. This article is published under the heading Settler Attacks on Palestinian Olive Harvest Most Dangerous in Years. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In the space of less than 10 days, Musleh Badawi and his family have been attacked 3 separate times by settlers while working on their land and picking olives. This year's harvest season, which runs between October and November, has been the hardest in recent memory for Badawi's family and other Palestinian families subjected to similar attacks. The olive harvest is a lifeline for some 80,000 to 100,000 Palestinian families in the occupied West Bank. We were preparing for the olive harvest season as if it were a big celebration. But today's events cast a dark shadow on the occasion due to the settler attacks. If that wasn't enough, we were also prevented from reaching our fields by the Israeli regime army, Musleh Badawi told Middle East Eye recently. Badawi mentions that during the first attack on October 29th, the culprits were from the adjacent Esh Kodesh settlement. They came to the farmers' lands and stole their harvesting equipment and 4 large sacks of olives that were estimated to contain 5,000 shekels, that is $1,600 worth of olives. We informed the Israeli police and Israeli coordination and Liaison office, but they ignored our complaints when they confirmed that the settlers were the perpetrators of the theft. Badawi, 71, is a father of 8 and a grandfather to 18, and his family depends on the olive trees as a primary source of income. Despite the repeated attacks they face, they haven't left their land and remain there constantly, he said. On November 5th, we went to our other tract of land near Elia settlement, which has 50 olive trees. We were surprised to see that the settlers had beat us to the land and had already picked the trees. The Israeli regime army then arrived and kicked us out. Later, the family suffered a third attack while they were on their land, a tract of 10 dunams, that is 1 hectare, near Hawiel outpost. Even though the area is considered Area B, the Israeli regime army still came and kicked us out, but only after we put up a fight until they were able to make us leave by force, Badawi said. He added that the repeated attacks on his family put them in constant fear of losing their land to colonization and being completely prevented from reaching their land in the coming years. Area B, according to the Oslo Accords, is administered by both the Israeli regime and the Palestinian Authority and has no Israeli settlements. The Badawi family's experience is familiar to scores of other Palestinian families during the olive harvest. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, in its latest report covering the period 5 to 18th of October, documented settlers' actions, which included damaging over 1,600 trees, most of them olive trees, or stealing Palestinians' harvest. These attacks took place in villages neighboring the cities of Nablus, Al-Khalil, Safit, Ramallah, and Al-Quds. Bashar Garouti, an anti-settlement activist, told Middle East Eye that the Zionist regime civil administration has issued new maps that plan for the confiscation of more lands and prevent dozens of Palestinian families from reaching their lands, estimated to comprise thousands of dunams. "What we have faced this year has been the most dangerous wave of attacks in years," says Garouti, adding it imposes a new status quo, especially in the middle region of the West Bank and Al-Khalil. He added that the settler attacks escalated during the olive harvest season against villages south of Nablus specifically, including the theft of olives and equipment, attacks against families, the obstruction of Palestinians accessing their fields, and the uprooting of hundreds of olive trees. He told Middle East Eye that the settlers have even planted sharp objects on the agricultural roads, damaging many Palestinian vehicles to prevent them from reaching their lands. Most settler attacks were carried out under the watchful eye of the Israeli regime civil administration and the Israeli regime army, who were content to sit back and watch, or even to provide protection to the settlers, Garouti added. Shahid Muhammad Azam, 53, confirms that having been the victim of an attack on his land 4 years ago by a known settler, Shahir lodged several complaints against the settler to no avail. Shahir is from the village of Garut. The Elia settlement surrounds his 11 dunams, that is 1.1 hectares of land, and the Israeli regime army prevents him from reaching it without prior permission. "When I arrived at my land, the settler going by the name Koron told me in front of the army and the civil administration that he had picked all of my olive trees and that nothing was left for me," he said. His land houses 60 olive trees and all have been illegally harvested through theft. Shahir told Middle East Eye that the attacks come not only during the olive harvest. Every time he goes to his land, settlers plant sharp objects on the nearby roads, resulting in damage to his tractor. Shahar's family of 11 has not been spared the ramifications. He said, "These attacks have destroyed me and my family. We rely on the olive harvest, and we had big hopes for this season. But because of these attacks, I am unable to pay for my daughter's university tuition, and she is now halted her studies. We used to sell olives and olive oil, but today we buy it and the settlers steal from our trees right in front of our eyes." He continued, "Last year the settlers stole our harvest and only a single branch was left unpicked. The settler told me that he left this one olive branch for me so that I could get a good look at how great those olives were, so that you'll get a heart attack and die. The settler Koron threatens him regularly, telling him, 'I'm way above the police. You won't be able to reach me with your complaints.'" Muayyad Basharat, Programs and Project Manager at the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, told Middle East Eye that on October 13th, the union launched its annual campaign to assist Palestinian villagers whose lands are located in endangered areas through the presence of international groups and volunteers during the harvest. During the second half of October, he says, 95 settler attacks have been recorded in the villages of southern Nablus. Settler attacks escalate throughout the olive picking season with the objective of emptying the land of any Palestinian presence. Settlers were further provoked by the presence of dozens of Palestinians this year who came to assist the farmers and affirm their commitment to the land, which the settlers reject. He added, despite our presence in large numbers in order to provide protection to the farmers, the settlers still launched widespread attacks, cutting trees, stealing harvests and tools, and harassing the villagers within eyeshot of the army and the Israeli regime civilian administration. They paid no heed to the international organizations that were present. Muayyad affirmed that the settler attacks and army harassment have increased in general recently, and what was clear this time is that the attacks were in much larger numbers than before. The settlers were also accompanied by army escorts, and they expelled dozens of families from their lands, despite the fact those families had obtained permits to be there from the Israeli regime civil administration. According to UN data, almost half of Palestinian agricultural lands are planted, with an estimated 10 million olive trees in the West Bank and besieged Gaza Strip. The International Committee of the Red Cross said that more than 9,300 olive trees belonging to the Palestinian farmers were damaged, cut, or uprooted by the Zionist settlers between August 2020 and August 2021.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
The U.S. occupied Afghanistan for 20 years and brought all sorts of oppression against the Afghan people. They bombarded their mourning ceremonies and their weddings. They killed their youth. They imprisoned many individuals, without any reason, in different prisons, and they increased the production of addictive drugs in Afghanistan by tens of times. They did all of these, but refused to take one step to help develop Afghanistan. In other words, if today's Afghanistan, in terms of civil rights, construction, and other such developments, is not worse than those days, it is not better either. So, the US did nothing. Now that they are leaving, it is in such a disgraceful way. Look at the situation in the Kabul airport, the large crowds, and the problems. They only take those who have cooperated with them over all these years and they wish to take. But there are reports showing that their situation is worse than those who stay. There are numerous problems for them in the centers where they are being kept. This is how the US is.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In any case, we support the nation of Afghanistan. Governments come and go. All sorts of governments held power in Afghanistan over these years. So, governments come and go. It is the people of Afghanistan who are permanently there. We support the nation of Afghanistan. The nature of our relations with the governments depends on the nature of their relations with us. May God bring the best situation for the nation of Afghanistan, liberating them from the situation and putting them in the best of conditions. I hope that he bestows his blessings on them and on us, God willing. I hope that God bestows success on the Iranian nation and eliminates the problems. I pray that you honorable officials of the new administration will succeed in the tasks that you have undertaken and overcome the problems. I hope that you fulfill your promises, help the people with their problems and satisfy the people, God willing. The people's satisfaction will lead to the satisfaction of God, the Exalted as well. Having pure and divine intentions and having the intention to serve will help you. God's mercy be upon our dear martyrs, upon our magnanimous Imam, and upon all those who worked for the sake of God and on the path of the truth. Greetings be upon you and God's mercy and blessings.
Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Palestinian factions in the blockaded Gaza Strip protested in front of the UNRWA office against aid cuts and demanded the agency scrap the so-called framework agreement with the United States. The framework agreement signed last July is a two-year working plan between the U.S. State Department and UNRWA. The protest comes less than a week ahead of the International Conference on UNRWA that will be held in Brussels under the chairmanship of Jordan and Sweden. The Hamas movement said the agreement exposes Palestinian refugees to grave dangers.
We call on donor countries to provide UNRWA with all necessary funding and alleviate the suffering of millions of Palestinian refugees. We also maintain that the framework agreement will place UNRWA under the U.S. hegemony and undermine the Palestinian refugees' right of return to the land of their ancestors.
The UN agency provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in Al-Quds, the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. During a press conference, Palestinian factions slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of Palestinian refugees.
Settler colonialist regimes that helped Zionist gangs occupy Palestine and displace its people in 1948 must stop helping the Israeli regime. Upon the creation of the illegitimate Zionist entity, those gangs destroyed over 500 Palestinian towns and villages and committed dozens of massacres against the indigenous Palestinian population.
UNRWA has long been a priority target for the Israeli regime and its allies. Over the past decades, the Israeli regime had been campaigning to defund UNRWA and end its mandate.
The so-called framework agreements between the United States and UNRWA aims to cancel the rights of Palestinian refugees. Palestinians across the political spectrum denounced the agreement. The U.S. wants to turn the UNRWA into a security agency in the occupied territories.
Experts say the so-called framework agreement with UNRWA is an attempt by the United States to delegitimize and depoliticize the issue of Palestinian refugees. UNRWA is a UN agency responsible for the welfare of millions of Palestinian refugees in West Asia who were displaced and dispossessed upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment, and custodial torture continue with impunity while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Major problem in Pakistan.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over seven decades. Both countries claim the region in full, but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Is
Islamic Jihad movement held a massive festival in the Gaza Strip marking the second anniversary of the assassination of Baha Abul Atta, Islamic Jihad commander, who was killed by Israeli airstrikes on his house. Targeting Abul Atta triggered a tough round of violence between Palestinians and the Israeli regime.
We are here to express our support to the resistance front that has never failed to defend us. Palestinians in Gaza are living in a continuous struggle, but this makes us more determined to defend our rights.
Baha Abul Atta was the head of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad. Baha was one of the most prominent members of its military wing and played a major role in carrying out operations against Israel.
We will remain steadfast and committed to our oath to our leader, Baha Abul Atta. Losing our commanders won't undermine our resistance. We will resist and won't be hesitant to defend our people and the Palestinian cause.
Palestinians in this event also stressed following in the footsteps of Abul Atta in the battle against the Israeli occupation, vowing to keep their resistance until their rights are restored.
Our message to the Israeli regime is that if you assassinate a leader, there will be thousands of other leaders to continue the path of resistance. The killing of Palestinian leaders won't undermine our will to keep up our fight against Israel.
Palestinians here say that the killing of the leaders won't stop the battle against the Zionists. They also vow to remain committed to their resistance as their only means to defend their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
New Delhi hosted a third regional summit to discuss the ongoing situation in neighboring Afghanistan. Following the recent pullout of U.S. and NATO forces from the country, the conference was chaired by India's National Security Advisor Ajit Doval and his counterparts from other Central Asian nations. India's National Security Advisor opened the dialogue.
We all have been keenly watching the developments in that country. These have important implications not only for the people of Afghanistan, but also for its neighbors and the region. This is the time for close consultations amongst us, greater cooperation and interaction, and coordination among the regional countries.
Top security officials reiterated pledge to work for ensuring safe Afghanistan and what they called free of safe haven for global terrorism. The delegates also called for formation of inclusive government in Kabul, stressing the territory should not be used for sheltering, training, planning or financing terror activities.
This could perhaps be the first time Central Asian countries are coming together on a single platform to not only discuss their role in rebuilding war-ravaged Afghanistan, but also formulate a collective strategies which could promote peace, stability and security in the region.
Issues related to radicalization, extremism, separatism and drug trafficking in the region were also discussed in the meeting. The officials expressed deep concern about the sufferings Afghan people have endured before and after the U.S. fallout. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, stressed on rebuilding inclusive Afghanistan, saying U.S. policies brought nothing but miseries and devastation in the region.
Afghanistan's neighbors need to fulfill its duties to settle the crisis unfolding in the country, including efforts to hold to account the countries behind the current situation there, establish an inclusive government comprised of all ethnicities there, and tackle the humanitarian crisis gripping the war-torn country. The Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to rebuild Afghanistan. Regional partners should also exert pressure on the United States to unblock the financial resources of the oppressed nation.
Security chiefs from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan also attended the talks. However, neighboring China and Pakistan did not attend the forum, citing scheduling reasons. The first two editions of the event were held in Iran in September 2018 and December 2019. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Leaving amid shouts of shame, Israel's UK ambassador, Zippy Hotovly, escorted flower in hand by her security detail to her car as British police ward off peaceful pro-Palestine protesters earlier this week. Hatoli, a fervent opponent of Palestinian statehood, had been controversially invited by the London School of Economics Student Union to a debate on Middle East peace.
As she emerged from the debate, she was met with students and pro-Palestine activists exercising their democratic right to protest. But there was a problem with that. It was a peaceful protest against the ambassador of one of Britain's closest allies with powerful pressure groups in British politics.
That has meant a torrent of criticism and condemnation from the pro-Israel media and government ministers. From the British Foreign Secretary, who has called the protest unacceptable, to the Home Secretary, who has described it as disgusting and anti-Semitic.
Where is the evidence for this? People were opposing the Israeli policy at one, and secondly, this particular ambassador who actually says there is no such a thing as Palestinians. Every inch of the land belongs to the Israelis. So by that definition means that this is encouragement to ethnic cleansing.
Once again, an expression of solidarity for Palestinians portrayed as anti-Semitism. One of the targets of that labeling, the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission himself, who has spent a lifetime calling out the Israeli regime's repressive apartheid against Palestinians.
What do? They actually try to be sort of racist towards others, use the only tool that they could possibly use of saying anti-Semitic, and then sort of trying mud at everybody else who's trying to stand up for justice and say, this is standard, this type of person should not be given a voice. If you look at genocide and ethnic cleansing, it always starts by denying people of their right to live where they are living.
It's a curious thing about freedom of speech and of expression in the UK. While it's free against some, it's restricted against others. Saeed Purza, London.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bakhari Khani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK Foreign Ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General stressed that the resistance in Lebanon has prevented full U.S. hegemony over Lebanon and has prevented civil war. Underlining the achievements of the resistance, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that one of the most tangible results is the fact that Israel is deterred from launching aggressions and even fears the strength of the resistance.
For the first time, Israel is living in a deeply rooted state of fear and concern for its existence. The elites in this